From the Melanina Zuckerman College of Public Health at the University of Arizona, this is Keeping Up with Public Health, Pandemic Response. This episode, we hear from Mona Arora and Andrew Comrie. Dr. Arora is a principal research specialist and course instructor at the Melanina Zuckerman College of Public Health. Her research focuses on building the public health system's capacity and capability to address the health impacts of climate change, with a special focus on the usability of science for decision-making and models for translating science into action. Dr. Arora has over 10 years' experience in emergency preparedness, workforce development, and community engagement. Dr. Comrie is an interdisciplinary climate scientist and geographer at the University of Arizona. He is a professor with a primary appointment at the School of Geography and Development, with joint appointments in hydrology and atmospheric sciences, and in public health. His research links climate with health, pathogens, and vectors, as well as with broader atmospheric environmental issues. Dr. Comrie has published widely in specialized and interdisciplinary international journals, and his work has been funded by numerous federal, state, and local agencies. Our conversation begins with the discussion on the One Health approach and ends with how policy change begins with behavior change and community buy-in.
When we think of One Health is a central concept. It's a holistic idea that places animals, environment, all connected together. So it's basically an idea that brings together an integrated strategy. So when we're looking at health and well-being, we don't take a siloed approach. We actually bring in different public and private partnerships. We bring in different disciplines. We bring in different sectors with this whole idea to integrate knowledge, integrate information, integrate technology in an effort to understand risks, in an effort to understand and inform health and well-being. And there's multiple ways to do that. At a government level, you can bring in, surveillance systems at, international levels, national levels, even down to a local level. But the premises and the strong foundation of One Health is to really move away from a siloed approach to health and really start looking at the interconnections that drive, human, animal, human, environmental, and other interconnected relationships, and use that understanding to drive home the solutions.
Yeah, that's pretty good. I mean, I always had the sense that One Health was the systemic approach, and to use the sort of zoonosis human disease connection as a good example, you're really not going to solve something like COVID or the flu or any of these other things at their heart unless you understand that there are connections, as you say, across the silos, and that for that reason, an epidemiologist needs to talk to an ecologist who needs to talk to a soil scientist who needs to, again, talk to local doctors. And it's a complex system. And so we have to study the whole system.
Right. And I think, Andrew, you hit up on a good point. When we talk about One Health, we talk a lot about the zoonotic diseases, the hantaviruses, the COVID-19s, and so on. But, all these vector-borne diseases, like the malarias. But we also need to keep in mind that even elements to occupational health, elements to like antibiotic resistance, food safety and food security. These are all issues that are driven by what we call One Health phenomena. And One Health phenomena, for example, can be climate change. Any type of phenomena that doesn't acknowledge these boundaries and can actually have different impacts at these three different crossings.
Yeah, you and I have talked before about this thing you just mentioned, which is that climate change in regards to public health is a really interesting element of how we consider its interactions with everything else. So the parallels I know you've drawn are like whether it's smoking across public health or it's the disparities. These are sort of socioeconomic origin that, if you just studied public health as the diseases people got and how to prevent them in the population without regard to socioeconomic status, access to healthcare, and all the other things, you would be missing half the point. And I think the same is true in climate change, in that it's a kind of a lens or a filter that when you look at public health with through that lens, that you suddenly see multiple connections between different parts. And hence the discussion of One Health, that you really can't address a single element of public health without thinking about socioeconomic status, but you also can't do it without thinking about the role of climate and climate change. And that's, I think, where the One Health connection is really strong. So it sort of touches many, many bases in public health. And it's tough because it's not really visible, right? It's a broader factor. And, you know, sure, you can have Hurricane Katrina and some very obvious emergent kind of issues that you have to deal with. But so much more of climate change is a slow, relatively silent or invisible set of effects that are not easy to pick up in everyday terms, and yet really undergird our understanding of many, many aspects of public health. Particularly, you know, we mentioned zoonoses, but there are obvious ecological connections there, but there are many others that are not. A good example would be something like nutrition or food, where, you know, with secondary or even a tertiary connection to some sort of acute condition that a person might have, and yet really a systemic issue at some level as well.
And I think that's a good point. The examples that you gave, Andrew, I think the commonality in these is nowadays we tend to call these our wicked problems. These are highly complex problems, and for which we really can't take a modeling only approach. But to address any of these issues, you not only need different perspectives, but you need to have different tools in your toolbox. So it could be surveillance, it could be behavioral change, right? Understanding how people tend to behave, what is going to require them, what is going to motivate them to take an action or to curb their, you know, meat consumption behavior, for example. That's one of the classic One Health issues that we come across with. The nexus between humans' meat consumption habits and how they lead to this domino impact on things like purchasing more meat products, relying more on some of these avenues for consuming these food products, and then further on out, what are those ramifications not only for nutrition, but also from a climate change perspective, from greenhouse gas emissions on this whole food web concept that we come across?
Yeah, you know, when I talk about this to lay audiences from time to time, I remember years ago when I first got into this intersection of climate and health, and was trying to explain to other audiences, you know, why it was so complicated, why it was that we knew a lot about climate change impacts or the prospective climate change impacts for certain things, and yet we knew at the time almost nothing about the health impacts of climate change. And I had this Venn diagram I would put up on my slides. I still do this. Two intersecting circles. And the one is social systems, and the other one is health systems, right? And of course, they're overlapping, and which is where the climate and disease interaction is produced. And the key part of this diagram is that it's two complex systems. Society is an incredibly complex thing to understand, and health is an incredibly complex thing to understand, even just the biophysical and natural parts of health, let alone all the social parts. You overlap those two, and you get really a kind of a complexity to the squared power there, which is why it's really tricky to figure out what these connections are and what they might be in the future. And I think this is key to a holistic understanding of where climate and health intersect, is that we've got to realize that there are multiple systems that can reinforce or counteract one another. So you don't always see the effects you think you're going to see. Other times you see them quite extreme. And those intersections, and understand them in a sort of this context of One Health, of complex systems, I think is a really key philosophical approach. Now, I say that, and if I'm working in the public health agency of my local county, and I've got a particular problem facing me, and maybe nothing even as dramatic as COVID, but just whatever it is, it may not be that any one of those connections is a sort of primary obvious factor that's affecting what I'm looking at, but it's absolutely critical to keep that in the back of my mind, because just when you least expect it, the simple behavior, whatever is in front of me, is going to be influenced by some bigger system concept, and that's when it's critical. So yeah, this is sounding awfully geeky and theoretical here about how we approach these health and climate problems, but I think it took a while for us to develop that philosophy as researchers in the last 20, 30, 40 years. And now I think we all embrace it because, you know, it has to be the way that we can, you know, make progress as we move forward.
Coming back to your point, Andrew, you know, when we're looking at it from a local public health perspective, I agree. You know, a lot of times, you know, we as in scientists often get really, really focused in on these bigger, grander challenges and wicked problems. Whereas, you know, if we come down to the boots on the ground in a practical level, you know, what is the health department today dealing with? You know, right, COVID-19 is an issue. But if we take a step back, it's some of those tangential impacts to food security, to health and well-being, to malnutrition, air pollution. We're in under an extreme heat wave right now. We're seeing above 105 temperatures, right? Those are some of the present day challenges today, even in the context, you know, in with this COVID-19 pandemic in the background. I think the important aspect for people to consider is not just that, you know, a One Health approach or a systems thinking approach. Yes, it's relevant to all of these bigger issues, but it's equally relevant to our day-to-day public health issues that we deal with. Health equity, access to healthcare, access to food, access to education, all of these are public health challenges, right? And so if we take a step back, the social determinants of health, these are key drivers, no matter which one of these issues that we pick and we decide to tackle. So it doesn't matter if you're in a rural health department versus an urban health department, there are a lot of commonalities, a common range of factors that ultimately impact human health and well-being. And having a broader understanding and or an awareness of issues being possibly interlinked, I think is an important facet to bring out and for people to consider.
Yeah, do you think these days that we do a good job either with the those folks who are professionals already or those who we train of sort of getting this point across that we've been talking about? I don't always think we do, maybe because we do have to make the point a lot, but maybe because it's not always intuitive either. So how do you think we're doing at that? And, you know, is there something we can do to make it better?
Yeah. I think it's a good question. I think there are opportunities for us to improve on it. And it depends on who we're talking about. Are we talking about public health professionals in the field? Yes. If that's the case, I think we need to be able to give them the tools, give them some of the fundamental concepts to bring some of this together. And having said that, I can hear people saying, you know, hearing this podcast and saying, well, Mona, Andrew, you know, we're in the midst of all of these challenges, right? There's an opioid epidemic going on, and there's so many other issues that day to day we're interfacing and we're troubleshooting. Where does this room come in? And I think one aspect I think for people to consider is really working outside of their comfort zone and working with people outside of their sectors and seeking those opportunities to bring in people who have the expertise to help problems is an important facet. But also when it comes to, Andrew, and I want to hear kind of from you on this, you know, we've worked on really bringing together the importance of training and building knowledge and capacity in the workforce. In this day and age with this COVID-19 pandemic really being at the forefront, how do we make inways to highlight some of these tools and to elevate our understanding of the application of something like One Health?
Yeah, that's really interesting. I haven't given a lot of thought, but as you were talking, I think it sort of triggered this one thing in my mind that is easy to overlook these days. Climate change as a problem, one of the wicked problems you mentioned, has not been around sufficiently long as a concept and as a problem that we're almost a little jaded, right? It's a long-term problem. It's not always immediate, and you get crises coming along such as a pandemic, and it can easily divert you in the short run, and that's fine. That's the nature of these things. But I think it's easy to forget that, you know, we're talking about being in the business of health here. The, you know, if health is about doing well and surviving, the ultimate survival issue is climate change. We're changing literally everything that, that about nature that our society is built on. And that includes some very direct health effects as some of these indirect ones we've mentioned. And it's easy to overlook the fact that it may be a long range problem on the order of a decades to, it took us a long time to get in, it's gonna take us a while to get out. But therefore, it's a little bit too easy to put on the back burner, like I'm not gonna worry about that now. And of course, we've been doing that for several decades already and have not made a lot of progress. If we started a while back, we could have done so. And there are many lessons from public health as to how we might get there, but a separate issue. But the key thing I think about climate change is that it is the ultimate survival question, right? Mm-hmm. Why bother with fixing all these other things if that's one that's gonna come and catch us later that we're not dealing with? So the challenge with any problem like this that builds up slowly, and yet, we have to, the parallels here are almost cliched, but we're addicted to using fossil fuels. This is like smoking cessation or something else. How do we make hard decisions now about real life choices that are really about something that will only pay off in the long run and maybe not even for us directly? That, that's the essence of the climate change challenge, is that we really are stuck with what it is we're doing, and some of those changes are quite hard to make. And it's a lot easier to defer them, especially when there's a lot of debate about, the trade-offs we have to make with energy choices, for example. But as we go through those motions, it really is parallel to everything we've learned from other big long-term problems that are sort of low-key in the present, but a big deal in the future. So I think there's a lot to be said there about how climate change problem as a whole intersects with where public health is at, because at some point it is the ultimate survival game. So maybe we go with that angle.
Right. And I think when we're looking at climate change and a lot of, and Hugh hinted at this earlier, we usually look for big visual events. And, yes, there's going to be the Katrinas, and the large wildfires, but there's so many other mechanisms through which climate change is apparent and the impacts of climate change on not just human, but animal health and well-being are visible. And, we talked a little bit about extreme heat. But I think coming at it from a public health standpoint and going back to the question that you were asking a little bit earlier, I think it's important for public health professionals to start recognizing that climate change is existing and it's an underlying issue that is influencing all aspects of our society. And because societies are interconnected, we're connected with the environment, and even within the human dimension alone, there's so many overlaps where now the zip code that we live in matters just as much, if not more, than our genetic code. We can't ignore the underlying drivers of all of these issues. But I do want to ask you a question, Andrew. So you were talking about trade-offs and, making those trade-offs and, making some hard decisions today, for the betterment of tomorrow or the future. We were in a period of about a month to 2 months in the spring where we, through lockdowns and through, some of these other social distancing restrictions, we made some of these trade-offs. What are your thoughts on how that can inform us moving forward? Do you think people are more or less likely now that they have had to give up and sacrifice some of their liberties, for the lack of a better word, as we kind of move forward? Could any of this inform our future strategies for climate change?
I would like to think so, but and while I'm usually an optimist, I've been accused of being a glass three quarters full kind of person. I'm also a realist, and I think human nature is really hard to change. So that while we, different folks have struggled with all the constraints of being on lockdown, for example, because of its immediacy, we handle something like the pandemic in a very different way than we handle something that's not as immediate that we can put off. The difference here is a hurricane versus a drought. They can both be just as devastating. The one is emergent and acute. The other one is chronic. Dealing with chronic problems, particularly when the things we have to do today are hard choices, it's just easy to kick that can down the road. And so I hope we can find some lessons. And I'm sure that I know there are some there. But to the extent to which that will make a difference to what we all do as societies, I'm way less confident, only because we've had countless emergencies and countless crises over the last 20, 30 years. And every one of them is supposed to, you know, help us get a bit further in addressing the long-term problem of climate change. And, you know, we've made we found incremental benefits there. We really haven't seen this galvanization of effort. So I think it's going to be a sort of a low and slow and more structural kind of issue that, you know, climate change policy is a whole other podcast.
I was just going to jump off of that. We see the pandemic, and the pandemic has crossed borders, and we're looking at now, you know, borders are closing, countries aren't allowing crossover, even within states within the U.S., you know, they're asking you to self-isolate for 2 weeks if you come from certain places. But we look at an issue like climate change and deforestation and carbon emissions and intensive or large scale farming, and all of those problems cross borders. It's not just one country that can work on these things. It's our whole planet that has to come together. And it seems like currently I've seen a few media articles touch on that because we're dealing with a pandemic, that these other climate goals and climate issues, you know, are taking the back burner right now. And for, you know, as you were saying, for the long-term goal, we can't do that. We can't afford to do that.
Yeah, you know, Mona, I know you just had taught a class where they took on this exact problem. What do the university students of today think about that?
Yeah, I think so. In the class that I teach, the students actually took on this issue of, you know, what can we learn from the COVID-19 response and how things have panned out. And, you know, I think students are worried, and I've seen this not just in my class, but in several dialogues that I've been kind of coming across as, you know, there is a heightened sense of awareness that, you know, all these systems are interlinked, and that we as humans have a role to play. And I think the COVID-19 pandemic really, and Caitlin, I think you used this, you kind of highlighted this, that, you know, this issue can't wait for tomorrow, right? And it should actually, it's an example of an issue where we need to come together. And we need to come together not just to be reactive and respond to this issue, but we also need to come together to look at, you know, what the future holds for us. And so, you know, some of the things that our students who were working on this project found out were there are a lot of commonalities and struggles that we saw when we work on climate change action adaptation that we saw with COVID-19 response. You know, we're a highly, and Andrew hinted at this, you know, we're a highly reactive society. And so motivating people to do behavioral change early on is very tough to do. Now, is it impossible? I don't think so. We definitely were able to make some kind of headway, you know, when things got really dire. I think what we need to start working on, and, you know, possibly, you know, for a research agenda, if we were kind of focusing on that leg of it, is trying to look at what are some of those enabling dialogues? How do we communicate better to the public, to our policymakers? How do we start taking these seemingly isolated events, and how do we bring them together? You know, and we can, another example I just want to bring out from this paper, you know, we looked at health equities. When we look at climate change, we, you know, one of the common denominators, so to speak, of health outcomes is the health equity issue, our race, where we live, how much we earn, right? All of those really influence how our vulnerability and our risk, right? So those things impact our vulnerability and risk, which will ultimately impact our health outcomes. Well, those denominators are the exact same for COVID-19. The statistics are showing us that people who are highest at risk for COVID-19, different age groups, individuals with limited access to health insurance, right? Underlying health conditions like asthma, right? Like respiratory diseases, all of which are also compounded by air pollution, So where they live, what kind of the quality of air, all of those are interlinked. So, you know, when I talk to students in my class, and, you know, I think, you know, there's a lot of concern, but I think there's also a degree of optimism to start, you know, advocating more, to try to take more action on issues that matter to people. Would you agree, Andrew? I mean, what are you seeing in your neck of the woods?
When I teach intro environment, intro climate, that sort of thing, I see much the same optimism. I think in students, they understand what's at stake. They're keen to learn more. And they have, a pretty constructive attitude, actually, about what needs to be done. But I also sense their frustration, right? These are all 18 to 22-year-olds. Their frustration with things not moving fast enough and how we can be so mired in sort of policy gridlock, for want of a better word, about what to do about fill in the blank big problem, including climate change. And I don't know that they always have really good ways of trying to figure out how to break through that. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's certainly plenty of energy with exciting ideas about, oh, we could try this and we can try that. But the sort of the bigger, deeper, substantive, complex but necessary things that need to change societally as well as environmentally, students naturally struggle those. They haven't had as much exposure to, you know, the messiness of change in the real world and what that takes and, to be honest, the true politics of it all. I still think, you know, the best parallel in so many ways for the climate change problem is, at least in the context we're talking about here, is the smoking problem. There are so many parallels with what the industry needs and information campaign is about, the kind of money that's tied up in it all, the sort of societal addiction, if you want to use the metaphor here, to fossil fuels versus nicotine, the benefits it provides. I mean, you know, there are alternatives, but it's not quite there yet. And the way that this is sort of baked into what we do, and I think the level of change we need is, of course, even deeper than the kind of change we need, whether it's behavioral or structural, where we've dealt with the issues surrounding trying to improve climate change. So all of these, I think, are sort of lessons for us here. And I see students struggling a bit with the kind of the time scale, because this is the lifetimes we're talking about. And yet at the same time, having immense energy. It's very exciting to be around people who are very can-do about where, you know, how we can solve these problems. That's the fun of course, you know, working in topics like this with people who have a lot of energy. So yeah, I think optimistic, but needing some real insight into sort of deep, complex societal problem solving and behavior change.
Right, and skills. I think, and I want to add to the frustration, I think you're spot on that. And this was something we talked about a lot, especially after, you know, after spring break and COVID-19 started, you know, evolving and becoming, you know, a pressing issue, was the misinformation. And these are students are, you know, heavy on social media. They're very engaged, more so than probably people like me. But they were flabbergasted about the amount of misinformation they saw. And it was really, you know, and really interesting, you know, discussions happened in the perspective of, you know, many of these were public health students. So they're familiar with public health fundamentals. They have access to, you know, what we would call the credible resources and data, and they feel they're comfortable sifting through articles and knowing, you know, this is hazy science versus this is on solid ground. And a lot of times, you know, they struggled with, you know, even family members who really questioned the science of the outbreak, the science of, you know, the recommendations that were being made. And I think, and that was, and I would say, Andrew, you know, you're absolutely right. There's energy and there's optimism there, but I feel like what we could be doing better, we as in you and I sitting in an academic setting, is to try to give them more tools, you know, to try to not just connect the dots, but to give them some of these tools to tackle these problems. Because you're right, you know, these are systemic problems, and change policy change in particular does not happen overnight. You know, it takes, how long did it take for us to, you know, make it, you know, make seatbelts mandatory? It took us quite a few years, and it was an uphill battle against the system, against, you know, the status quo and all these fund agencies that were funding, you know, the opposing narrative. And we have the similar issue here with climate change, and not even climate change, but even just the COVID-19, what we see day in and day out.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. Could not agree more.
I wanted to pick up on something, but it just kept getting better as you guys were talking. And I wanted to see if we could bridge the public health students that you were speaking about, Mona, and the lay public. They have something in common, but the public health students already crossed that bridge and they're motivated to do this. So then after a certain amount of time becomes a problem of remaining motivated to keep holding that torch and burning on. And then also on the other side with the lay public, for a while, these recommendations, social distancing, wearing masks, sanitization of different things, a bunch of them jumped on board like wholeheartedly, really, really hard. And then they kind of became desensitized over time. Is there something, and again, this gets into another part that I wanted to talk about before, was we got to where we are from so many incremental changes throughout civilization. And it's likely going to take an equal amount, if not more, of incremental changes to start heading in a direction where we are. But when we pick up these tasks, we like to think that our task alone is what's going to be the one that changes the world. You know, by wearing masks, we're going to solve this problem. Or by staying at home and isolating, we're going to solve this problem. But it is actually much more complex. And I feel like I'm on a soapbox. Sorry about that. But I think there's a lot that can be done with Unify. And you guys have touched on this, and I want to touch on it more. There's a lot that can be done with unifying it by taking that One Health approach, realizing that a lot of it is connected, and kind of releasing that expectation that this one thing that we are going to do is what is going to be the change of rules, but actually look into it as that we are part of this system, that, you know, by these little incremental changes, we will gradually be in a better direction as long as everybody remains motivated and keeps it up. Do you talk about remaining motivated in any of your classes?
I certainly do in my classes, because this issue we were just talking about of sort of channeling the optimism is absolutely key. And, you know, that on these really complex problems, the way we make big policy and action progress is through, you know, to your point about our one single action may or may not make a difference, through a myriad of issues working or people working on issues over time, building a kind of a potential up so that when the right policy moment hits, the crisis du jour, whatever it is at that point, when the policy and political stars align, then you're prepared for those things to go through. And that, because the nature of change like that is that it's not just you can flip the switch, right? You really need to be well prepared. And you need to have all the arguments and all the assets marshaled for change so that when the opportunity presents itself, you really can, right? There's not a lot of luck involved in this. You need to be prepared, and then the opportunity will present itself. So I think when we talk about, for example, in my classes, I'll talk about climate and climate change or environmental change more broadly, and there are all the elements of just understanding how it works and what, you know, what changes we might need to make. Understanding that some easy or seemingly easy changes that seem technocratic are actually some of the toughest social and political changes to make. The same is true in the health arena. So, you know, if you're, you know, if you have an obesity issue, well, just eat less. It's easy, right? And the same is true of so many complex environmental problems that, in fact, technocratically, well, duh, yes. Take in less energy or burn less fossil fuel is a simple technocratic solution, but completely divorced from the reality of what's really needed. And I think learning how to surmount those problems, the tools Mona was mentioning, is the way forward. And that's a combination of people working on many initiatives, as you were suggesting, Eric, and creating the kind of preparedness and pressure over time so that when there are windows of opportunity to make substantive change, that we really do them and we do the right thing when that window emerges, right? It's not a panic or a rush when we get there. And that's how almost all of these other things have happened, whether that was, you know, anti-smoking, anti-tobacco legislation, whether it was seatbelt legislation, to use the example Mona cited earlier, or you know, 1,000 other things. That's in effect how they happened. You can at times just build the public expectations such that a minor crisis happens and suddenly you see things with new eyes and you go, hold on, this is completely anachronistic. This doesn't have to be how it works. Let's just change it and move on. And you know, we've seen that even in the last year in social issues in the US. So it really can, it can happen, even though it seems like it takes for absolute ever sometimes. And it can be incredibly frustrating and wear you down if you are someone on the front lines who's just pushing all the time. And yet for some bigger reason, things just hadn't quite aligned to happen yet. So I feel like I'm talking a little bit in the abstract here, but when I look at issues, big complex issues where there's been change, that sort of pulsed change with sort of a buildup of pressures and then releases at appropriate opportune moments seems to be the way that it happens. And, you know, it's maybe framed in slightly more flippant terms by some politicians who say, never let a good crisis go to waste. And that's really the kind of gist of this, is that when you do have a good crisis, make sure you really are prepared and you have your ducks all in a row so that you can have informed, you know, change, not just a random rush to get something done in a hurry.
Yeah, and we talk about these concepts as well. And I think, and if I had to pick two key points that we usually coalesce around in classes, you know, one of them, and this is something Andrew and I've talked about a lot, is this whole science communication interface. I think in this era of misinformation, I think science information and being able to communicate effectively to your audience and knowing who your audience is very important. And it doesn't matter if you're a student and at the university, at a college, or you're a public health professional. The bottom line is we have our own arena of influence. We influence, you know, the people that we choose to associate ourselves with, our friends, our family members. How many times, you know, if you're in an airplane, you strike up a conversation because of what you're wearing, or, you know, a bag you're carrying or whatever, or a book you're reading, right? So it's really getting, I think one thing we always talk about is getting people comfortable in having this conversation about, in specific, climate change. You know, we've come across, you know, I think in the past 10 or so years, into this aversion. We don't want to talk about it. We don't feel comfortable talking about it. It's a highly politicized issue. And one of the things I think we need to start getting better at is understanding, you know, not just our audience and who we're communicating with, but understanding and feeling comfortable in having those conversations. And so how do you have those conversations? You know, and if you take, you know, any of the risk communication strategies, you know, that's all goes back to risk communication fundamentals. You know, what resonates with people? You know, and we saw this with climate change, and Andrew's gonna laugh because he's seen me make this same reference before, but we've talked, you know, gone are the days when we threw up an image of a polar bear on the North Pole. We found out that does not resonate. We wanna be able to have a conversation with you and I, with people that we interact with. And so in order to do that, we need to actually understand what is it that appeals to people's emotions, right? People care about their health. People care about their children, their elderly parents. And this is why I feel like, and we talk about this in the climate change and health class, this is why the health lens is so critical, right? Because it really unifies many of these wicked problems and the dialogue that needs to occur on those. And I think, Eric, to your point about, you know, there's a, not an aversion, but, you know, people get tired of it, right? Over the course of time. I think reframing,
that's why, is what you want, right?
Yes. So, you know,
quarantine fatigue,
quarantine fatigue, you know, or any, you know, any type of fatigue in this, I think we need to come back to, you know, creating new social norms. And how do we do that? You know, we do that by, you know, providing access to information, having these conversations, understanding what resonates with people. You know, we can't be talking to people. I mean, we talk this in some of the work that I'm doing on COVID-19. You know, we talk about, you know, well, what is the actual feasibility aspect of this whole notion of quarantining for 14 days? You know, can everybody equally do that? Can every community member have the facility to do that? And the answer is no. So if why are we in the business of making a recommendation that we know people are not likely to take? Well, what we should be doing is really looking at this recommendation and saying, okay, what can we do to enable people to follow through with this recommendation? Right? What kind of services can we provide? And I think, and that's, unfortunately, I feel like, you know, this is an area of improvement for us in public health is, you know, yes, we have these recommendations that we're making, but we really need to start looking at, okay, if these recommendations are not being followed, which we know today where we're standing, they're not being followed as highly as they should be, why aren't they being followed? And what should we be doing to enable that? Right, to make it easier for people to adapt. And I'm going to use a climate change example for that. You know, maybe what, 5 years ago, Andrew, 4 years ago, you know, plastic straws, that was the norm. And the notion of steel reusable straws or paper straws, recyclable straws, was fairly new. And where are we at today? We've gotten to a level through heavy marketing promotion, but also think about what we needed to do to get there. We needed to get buy-in from the business sector. We needed agencies and people to not only amplify the message, but then also to help make it easier for us to adopt reusable straws. And I think we need to learn from that, Andrew.
Yeah, there's so much about that in the climate change area too, whether it's alternative energy sources, renewable energy, for example, would be one. And you can get there in multiple ways. There's not just one way all the time. And you know, it's very easy to point the finger at industry X or at group Y or habit Z as to why we don't do something. And one of the first things we have to realize, of course, it's mostly us. And about what we're conditioned to do. And to your point, then what is it that's going to motivate us to change and how to understand that? And that's partly what others do to influence us, whether that's through advertising or social norming. It's partly through choices we make. And I think to the choices point, talking about One Health issues and climate change and environmental change more broadly with regard to public health, I think if public health professionals in general can feel like climate change and the related environmental changes are not something else that once in a while touches health, but in fact that they are voices to say climate change is everywhere, including in health. In fact, it's absolutely core to our understanding of health, and here's the way it touches, sometimes immediately, sometimes more remotely, and sort of pull that into us owning that it's all of us without necessarily always pointing fingers. And then that's a way to bring people in and to kind of move others in society who haven't realized what those connections are. So there's an agency here for professionals within public health to say, this is a piece of what we studied, even if it seems unfamiliar. This is a piece of what we're trying to fix. And that alone, if now that the public health profession is in about as prominent a position as it possibly could be in the news. This is the time as the public generally, despite all the nonsense going on in the press, generally trusts public health information and looks to public health professionals for advice. This is the time to be saying, as we're dealing with pandemics and everything else, also now there are these other big problems we're dealing with, and they have a health dimension too. And here's the stuff that's healthy for us as individuals and healthy for us as a society that we can talk about. I really think that in many professions, this one included, that's the way we have to go. And then that's how we change what we do as a society, because we'll prioritize things differently.
Mm-hmm. And you're right. If I can just add to that, Andrew, the health and public health professions are among the most trusted in our society, in our communities. And so there's a role that public health professionals can take, just like Andrew said, about elevating the dialogue on these issues and really bringing to light the underlying health impacts that cross-act these multiple wicked problems, so to speak.
That's a great spot to end on, and I would love to stay in chat for two more hours about this topic. You know, I love learning about this, but you know, we don't want to take up too much of your time. So thank you both. This has been a really informative for myself conversation, and I think for others listening as well. So thank you both.
Welcome. Thanks for inviting us.
Yeah, this was fun, Andrew.
Yeah.
I think we planned this, right?
You can get us talking anytime. We've done this for years.